This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Kenya's top university has been closed following unrest and allegations from students of police brutality. It is the latest sign of the deepening tensions over the rerun of the presidential election later this month.
That's VOA's Mohammed Yusuf reporting. We'll have full details coming up. Also, the U.S. city of Las Vegas commemorates the shooting victims at interfaith vigils. The UN Refugee Agency reports a huge surge in the numbers of refugees fleeing to Zambia. And the World Health Organization continues to ramp up its response to Madagascar's plague outbreak. We'll have these stories and more. Stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, in Uganda, attacks and restrictions on lawmakers opposed to lifting the presidential age limit continue. The homes of two MPs were hit with grenades early today. Halima Athumani reports for VOA from Kampala.
Robert Kyagulanyi, also known as Bobi Wine, was awoken in the wee hours of Tuesday morning to the sound of explosions. Three grenades had been thrown into his house. No one was injured. Kyagulanyi is the third lawmaker to have his residence attacked by grenades in the past week.
The threats have been on my life, and different cars, different people have been trailing me from outside home. I've been having calls telling me that they are actually going to kill me if I do not stop opposing the removal of the age limit. Last night, the three grenades were thrown at the window of my firstborn son.
Members of Kyagulanyi's staff tell VOA that shortly after this interview Tuesday, the MP was picked up by police for a second time in the past month. The Kampala Metropolitan Police spokesperson, Emiliano Kaima, told VOA investigations into the grenade attacks are ongoing, but he had no comment on Kyagulanyi's alleged arrest. In a tweet Tuesday, government spokesperson Ofwono Opondo accused the opposition of carrying out what he called the flashbang grenades as scare tactics to frame government. Several opposition lawmakers have been arrested and briefly detained in recent weeks, accused of inciting violence and causing public unrest. Security forces were deployed heavily throughout the capital Tuesday in anticipation of a walk-to-work protest announced by Ugandan opposition leader Kizza Besigye. The protest did not happen. The opposition has pledged to resist ruling party efforts to remove the presidential age limit of 75 from the constitution. The amendment would pave the way for long-time President Yoweri Museveni to run for a sixth term in office in 2021. 25 legislators opposed to the lifting of the age limit are expected back in parliament Thursday following a one-week suspension. They were forcefully ejected from the House amid fistfights on the parliamentary floor Wednesday as the ruling party prepared to introduce its motion to amend the constitution. The Uganda Communications Commission also has banned local media from hosting or giving live coverage to legislators opposed to lifting of the age limit, with the commission's executive director saying in a written statement to media houses that live radio and television broadcasts were inciting violence. Human rights lawyer Nicholas Opio told VOA his organization, Chapter 4, plans to challenge the broadcast ban in court.
The media is broadcasting the manipulations happening in parliament, the violence happening on ordinary Ugandans. And therefore, in order for them to be able to do what they want to do silently, the media has to be silenced. And I think that while we have a thriving media business in the region, I don't think we have a thriving media freedom. Many media owners have deep economic interests that are tied to the state and therefore tend to very quickly roll over when the state comes coughing.
A group of 230 Ugandan journalists calling themselves the Press Freedom Forum issued a statement on WhatsApp condemning the ban. The ruling party's bill to remove the presidential age limit from the constitution had its first reading in parliament Tuesday. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
Well, Well, Kenya's top university has been closed following unrest and allegations from students of police brutality. It is the latest sign of the deepening tensions over the rerun of the presidential election later this month. Mohammed Yusuf reports for VOA from Nairobi.
The University of Nairobi has been closed after days of unrest following the arrest of a student leader who is also a member of parliament. The lawmaker was arrested for insulting the president and also assaulting a voter. Last week's protest prompted some police officers to enter the university compound and beat up students, frog-marching others. In an interview with Nation Television, the head of the police said the university administration invited the police to deal with the situation at the school. The students planned a protest Tuesday against the police brutality and the school administration, but the university announced it was closed until further notice, citing what it called a deteriorating security situation. Student leader Ronnie Mamba disagrees with the stated reason for closure.
As you can see here, no student is armed. We are only armed with our brains. No student is carrying a gun. No student has clobbered another student. Therefore, there is no insecurity.
Angela Mbothia is the deputy chairperson of the students' union.
Students right now are really not happy with the situation, because what we had planned is to have a demonstration right now to ask for answers and know and find out why our vice-chancellor ordered the GSU to get into our university hostels and use excessive force on our students.
Mbothia acknowledges tensions over the rerun election between President Uhuru Kenyatta and his challenger Raila Odinga has spilled over into the university.
The country is a bit unstable right now, and it has been reflected in our university because now politicians are running into the university to get a share of votes that they can get from there and influence and everything that they can. So that is what is coming in and dividing students in such a magnified way.
Kenya's Electoral Commission met with the ruling Jubilee Party officials and opposition leaders Tuesday to discuss preparation for the October 26 presidential election. US, British and European Union envoys have called for both sides to give support to the electoral body in preparations for the vote. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Here in the U.S., an interfaith vigil in Las Vegas helped bring healing to a city that is reeling from an attack that left at least 59 people dead and nearly 600 injured late Sunday. As police try to understand what motivated the gunman, local leaders say they are celebrating the resilience of the community. Michael Sullivan reports.
Leaders of various faiths took turns sounding a gong in the Catholic cathedral, ringing it once for each of the dead in the worst mass shooting in recent U.S. history. Amanda Kahn helped organize the vigil.
I think we're all in shock, but mostly what I've seen today ever since waking up is there's been incredible community, and everyone has been reaching out, just asking what can they do, what can we do to help.
The attack by the 64-year-old gunman, Stephen Paddock, shocked the community. Police say Paddock had assembled a small arsenal and opened fire on 20,000 people attending an open-air concert from the 32nd floor of an adjacent hotel. Kenneth Zamora was at the concert with friends. He and his roommates left 30 minutes before the shooting started, but when they heard what happened, they worried about their friends who remained at the concert.
Luckily, we were able to get in contact with them because the hotels opened up their doors and let people hide within the casino rooms. I'm just happy that my family and friends are safe.
Survivors say there were countless acts of courage and neighbors helping neighbors. Stephen Sisolak, chairman of Clark County Commissioners, said the community response has been overwhelming. He said the many injuries led to a blood shortage in the hospitals.
We put out a call for blood to be donated. As a result of that, there is now an 8-hour waiting time to donate blood. You can't get an appointment to donate blood until next week. The community has responded in such a tremendous manner.
He says a call for financial help for the affected families brought in 25,000 donations, totaling $1.8 million. Cynthia Yap is a newcomer who settled in Las Vegas just 1 week ago. Monday, she was transporting food and water to volunteers conducting blood drives.
Everything has just been kind of a whirlwind for us, but it's been amazing to see the community come together. Vegas just really now feels like home to me.
Many are asking why mass shootings like this continue to happen. Amanda Khan worries about that too, but says this is a time for mourning and not for debates over guns and security.
I think it's important to just recognize that we're all just humans, and we have a personal duty to each other to take care of each other and, save the politics for tomorrow.
Those at the vigil say this is time to celebrate the many acts of love that counteract one horrible act of hatred. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Las Vegas.
The UN Refugee Agency reports a huge surge in the numbers of refugees fleeing to Zambia to escape growing violence in southeastern DRC. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says more than 3,360 refugees from the Democratic Republic of Congo have fled into northern Zambia since August 30th, making this the largest influx of Congolese into that country in the past 5 years. The UNHCR says increased intra-ethnic violence in the DRC provinces of Okatanga and Tanganyika, as well as fighting between Congolese security forces and militia groups, are driving civilians to cross the border. UNHCR spokesman Andre Mahechich warns insecurity in DRC is likely to lead to further displacement.
Those arriving in Zambia report extreme brutality, with civilians being killed, women raped, property looted, and houses set alight. Some 60% of those arriving in Zambia are children. Many show signs of malnutrition. Malaria, respiratory problems, dysentery, and skin infections are common among the refugees, who are now in urgent need of protection and life-saving support.
Mahechich says most of the refugees are being relocated to a transit center some 90 kilometers from the border. He notes some of the new arrivals remain at the border waiting for their families to cross. The spokesman tells VOA the UNHCR already has deployed emergency teams to Zambia to monitor the crisis and provide aid.
There was an earlier influx of which we spoke about some weeks ago. That was over a day. We've seen about 500 arrivals in 24 hours, and at that point we have deployed additional staff to that area. But I want to underline there are huge logistical challenges given the remoteness of the area and access.
Mahechich says the UNHCR is working with the Zambian government and Red Cross to distribute hot meals and identify people with special needs. He says psychosocial support is being provided for survivors of sexual and gender-based violence. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. In more news around the continent, the World Health Organization continues to ramp up its response to Madagascar's plague outbreak. The WHO says in the past 2 months, there have been at least 131 cases of bubonic or pneumonic plague, with 24 deaths. Madagascar has plague outbreaks annually, but this one has spread to urban areas, which increases the risk of more cases. Fleas transmit bubonic plague, but pneumonic plague spreads from person to person. Both can be cured if treated promptly. The WHO is working with the Madagascar Ministry of Public Health to track cases and take steps to stop the spread, such as isolating pneumonic plague patients. As of Monday, the WHO said there is a low risk of the outbreak that it will spread internationally. Since the 2011 uprising that ousted autocrat Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, Tunisia has avoided the violence that affected other nations after their Arab Spring uprisings. However, successive governments have struggled to enact economic reforms. A new Tunisian government is launching a war against economic and security challenges. VOA's Mohamed Elshenawi has details.
Tunisia's Prime Minister Youssef Chahed's broad government reshuffling creates what's being called a war cabinet to fight terrorism and corruption. Several regional experts say the new cabinet should have the impetus to push ahead with tough reforms on public sector wages and pension system to improve finances in line with the International Monetary Fund demands. Tunisia's economic recovery remains fragile, but there is optimism. The World Bank forecasts a growth rate of 2.5% this year and 3% next year. The IMF forecasts a robust gain of 4.7% by 2020. This optimism does not downplay the challenges ahead. Security, political, and social risks are high, cooling investor confidence. Osama Ramdani, former Tunisian communication minister, recommends some solutions.
The way out is economic growth, to refrain from big government spending and to encourage foreign investors to come and invest in Tunisia. And the international community should help. And internally, stability will go a long way towards encouraging also domestic investment. Restoring trust in the economy. Once that happens, you create more jobs, and when you create more jobs, you absorb unrest and you absorb frustration of young people.
The IMF shows that more than 30% of youth and women in Tunisia are unemployed. Investment is too weak to generate sufficient jobs, and deficits are stuck at high levels. Ramdani notes that the country has been hit by a series of shocks, such as terrorist attacks, which affected tourism and investment, and that corruption has eroded confidence in the economy. A new poll by the International Republican Institute reveals that the weak economy and corruption drive intense public dissatisfaction in Tunisia. Sarah Yerkes, a fellow in Carnegie Middle East program, says that while the Tunisian government has arrested some corrupt officials, it must address the real causes of corruption.
It's not just getting rid of some of the big fish. You need to actually address the structures. You need real sort of transitional justice process and a deep dive to figure out how have these structures existed? How have they been maintained over the past 7 years?
Yerkes said, addressing corruption the right way will create a more attractive business environment for Tunisian companies and foreign investors. An IMF loan of $2.9 billion last year is intended to provide a financial cushion while the country adopts changes needed to help the economy grow. Among the key goals, rapidly cutting public debt, which now stands at 60% of gross domestic product, and laying the foundations for sustainable growth that improves the lives of all Tunisians. Scott Mastic is Regional Director for the Middle East and North Africa at the International Republican Institute. He suggests that the so-called war government in Tunisia should have a clear roadmap to address challenges to the democratic transition.
Clearly, a focus on the economy, jobs creation, local economic development are things that should be very high on their agenda. With respect to the corruption issue, how to advance that war on corruption and have it result in tangible benefits for people that they actually see and believe that positive change is happening.
Regional experts say that a focus on those areas can turn around the widespread popular distrust that grew as consecutive governments failed to address the economic and social challenges of ordinary Tunisians. Mohamed Elshenawi, VOA News, Washington.
Worldwide, fewer women are online than men. In the U.S., women still struggle to break into the tech industry, and once there, many find it tough to thrive. This Thursday, Voice of America will hold a town hall at the world's largest gathering of women in technology in Orlando, Florida. VOA's Michelle Quinn reports with voicing done by Kate Dawson.
Around the world, women are using technology to leapfrog barriers in education and employment. But getting online remains a challenge for many women in developing countries. And in the U.S., far fewer women than men find success in technical careers. On October 5th, women leaders will discuss these issues at Voice of America's Town Hall at the Grace Hopper Celebration of Women in Computing, the world's largest gathering of women technologists. In the U.S., there is a lively debate over why women lag behind men in the tech industry. Globally, women struggle just to get access to technology. The proportion of women using the Internet is 12% lower than men. In the least developed countries, only 1 in 7 women uses the Internet, compared with 1 in 5 men. Martin Hilbert is a social science professor at the University of California, Davis.
So the digital divide is basically this phenomenon that some people have more access to digital technologies than others and or use it more than others, which is actually an unavoidable thing. Every innovation that comes to society doesn't form uniformly from heaven. It diffuses through society, right?
Women have less access to technology because they face discrimination when it comes to education, job opportunities, and income. Tara Chavlovsky, founder of a technology education nonprofit organization, says in some cases, they also face societal pressures.
There's a country in Africa where it's not cool for young girls to own phones, only middle-aged men. And so when we came in and we said we want to teach girls how to code and create a mobile app, they were like, why don't you teach the boys or why don't you teach these men? And so we had to work for many years to change those kinds of mindsets and barriers.
In the U.S., women make up about 20% of companies' technical workforce, although they are about half the overall labor force. They comprise about 17% of tech leadership. And when it comes to venture capitalists who finance the startup ecosystem, not many are women. Kate Mitchell at Scale Venture Partners is one of the few.
I joke that I chose the profession where I never have to stand in line at the bathroom because it's 5 to 10% of investing partners are women, depending on what study you look at.
Even when women are in tech roles in a business, they are at risk of leaving mid-career, some saying they felt they never belonged. Caroline Simard is a gender researcher at Stanford University in California.
Often women are held to a higher bar. To be successful, right? So they have to work harder to prove the same level, the same amount of competence.
But many are working on ways to close the digital divides, both around the world and in the U.S. Simard says the work won't be easy.
There is no magic fix. There is no magic bullet. The tech industry is famous for looking for quick, scalable solutions. And I think there is a lot of daily hard work that needs to happen to be inclusive, and it does mean really embedding it in every managerial practice.
At Voice of America's Town Hall at the Grace Hopper Celebration, leaders in technology will talk about what it will take to continue to close the digital gender divide. This is Kate Pound Dawson from VOA's Michelle Quinn in San Francisco.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of your breakfast show, Daybreak Africa. As always, our newsroom is on top of the news of your interest. We provide you with up-to-the-minute news about Africa as well as world news. tuning to our show right here on VOA Africa, your trusted source of news and information.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.